I wonder what you feel threatened by in your day-to-day life. Do you feel threatened by maybe people you meet? Is it people at work or at uni who you see as competition? Is it by, do you view things like the increased terrorism threat of our country as a threat? Perhaps you don't feel many threats yourself as an individual, but when you look at the sort of world today and the role of the church in the world, particularly in our country, you see that there are many threats to it. There is a perhaps growing antagonism to a lot of Christian beliefs and what the Bible says. You can see many statistics about decreased church attendance, a growth of atheism and other religions. You see more and more people openly defying God in the media and across the people we meet. We see legislation changing in ways we wouldn't like. Perhaps we view all these as a threat on the church. Perhaps these are the many threats at a personal level to our faith. People that don't like us talking about what we believe, don't want to hear what the Bible says, and maybe you worry about those things. It can be easy to fear and worry about what happens at that public level, even if it doesn't affect us directly, but what it means for the church, and to wonder if God is really in control and if he's really doing what he's promised. In our journey through 1 Samuel, we're at the point where Saul has sadly been rejected by God as king. But last week we found hope in the anointing of David to be a future king. It's only this week that we hear David speak or see him do anything. But now we start to see David's character through his words and actions, and we start to see God using him to save his people from the Philistines yet again. If you look at the start of our chapter, our story opens with the Philistines, who are long-time enemies of Israel, amassing an army and coming into Judah. They're on Israelite land. Verse 1, now the Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled at Succoth in Judah. They pitched their camp at Ephes Damim between Succoth and Azekah. The Philistines are a threat throughout the book of 1 Samuel. And we've already had several battles with them, as we've seen. And the Israelites assemble in response. Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up their battle line to meet the Philistines. The Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites another, with the valley in between them. So here we have the sort of the setting for our story. A valley on one side, the invading is a Philistine army. On the other are God's people. Both are lined up to fight. Probably neither side is keen to attack, as that would mean going down into the valley and then fighting uphill, putting them at a disadvantage. Perhaps that's why we get the challenge that we do. On the outline in front of you, I hope you can see that we're first introduced to a fierce enemy that threatens us, but that enemy isn't just an enemy of the Israelites in this case, but they're an enemy of God. We have God's champion, an unlikely hero in the form of a shepherd boy, who's not even in the army, but a man who looks beyond the outward appearance of the situation. And trusts God will keep the promises he has made to his people. God's champion brings the good news that we don't have to be afraid because he will fight for us. Finally, we're going to see that the great victory that God wins in defeating the enemy, and that's a victory that wins salvation for his people, glory for his name, and it's for the world to know. The whole world is to know about this great victory that he has won. And so we should see that in a world where we feel threatened by many different things, this well-loved story helps us not to fear, but to stand firm in the world, to have confidence in the living God, and to trust him to save us, however fierce the enemy seems. So the fierce enemy that threatens us is God's enemy. At the start of our story, we're confronted by this fierce enemy that dominates the description, particularly in verses 4 to 7. This extensive description and a picture of what he's like enables us to really see the terror that the army of Israel were facing. But we also see that this enemy wasn't just their enemy. In threatening God's people, Goliath was making an enemy of God himself. And that's something that should comfort us as God's people. Any enemy of God's is an enemy of God himself. Any enemy of God's people is an enemy of God himself. Picture it. You're lined up with your fellow Israelites on one side of a valley. From out of the Philistine ranks, you see a giant of a man walking to the front. You see him dressed head to toe in armor. He has impressive weapons. This is the Philistine champion, the mighty warrior. We're impressed by that description. His height, 3 meters tall, which I guarantee is taller than anyone you've ever met. And he is dressed to kill. He's got bronze helmet, bronze armor. His armor's weighing about as much as I weigh, minus one of my limbs. And he's got a javelin, a spear. If you don't know what a weaver's rod is, I didn't know what one was, but if you're picturing a giant man with a spear that doesn't look too small for him, you've got the right kind of picture. His shield's being carried by someone else, possibly because it's so big. And then this fearsome Philistine champion who has emerged from the ranks starts to shout across the valley to you, the Israelites. He issues a challenge to single combat. We see in verse 8, Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." The challenge is on Goliath's terms and plays to his strengths. Sort of lives can be saved by just one man from each side fighting to the death, each champion representing their nation. But who would want to fight this monster of a man? Imagine the terror as the biggest man you've ever seen, with the biggest spear you've ever seen, challenges you to go out and fight him. You have no chance, and there's no answer from the Israelite camp. So Goliath repeats his challenge, and adding a direct defiance. The Philistine says, "This day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man, and let us fight each other." And on hearing the Philistine's words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. And we'll look at the terror of Saul and the Israelites shortly. But what I want us to understand here is that Goliath is not just a fierce enemy standing there threatening the Israelites. In being against Israel, God's people, the Philistines are against God. Just like declaring a war against a country is to declare a war against the leader of that country. An attack on God's people is an attack on their king. And of course, their true king is God himself. We see this when David comes on the scene. He is one who, unlike the rest of the Israelites, understands that the Philistine isn't there defying the armies of Israel, as Goliath says there in verse 10. But he is defying God's people. He is mocking God himself. In verse 26, we see him saying, "Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" Verse 36, the second half of that, "This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them because he has defied the armies of the living God." And verse 45, he says the same thing. "I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied." It's an attack on God's armies, and so is an attack on God. It's God's armies, not Saul's, and it's God that is being challenged. Goliath talking about Israel, but David talks about God, and David is the one seeing the situation correctly here. We also see it in Goliath cursing David by his gods in verse 43, and knowing about the idols that the Philistines worship. We see that this situation is more than the Philistines against Israel, but the Philistines against a living God. So if this threat is God's enemy and not just his people's, then we can look to God to deal with it. This is an attack on God, so Israel only need trust God to fight the battle for them. And this is true for us too. We're not faced, ever faced with a giant challenging us to fight or in those kind of situations. But we all have an enemy that attacks us, particularly as individuals. We fight with sin. We have a battle, and it's a battle we can't overcome by our own determination or skill. It's a great power that we fight, but it's God's enemy. We look at Satan and Satan's attacks on the church. Satan attacks God's people throughout the history of the Bible. Here the attack is in the form of Goliath. In the Garden of Eden, it was the serpent tempting Adam and Eve. And today, Satan attacks the church in various ways. There's persecution, abuse, political opposition, even from within the church, with things like false teaching and how we act towards one another. But the comforting truth is that an attack on the church is an attack on God. And so it's not our battle so much as it's God's battle. And we can look to God to do something. So if we can look to God to do something and God will fight the battle, then, well, how does he fight it? Well, that's our second point. The Lord provides a champion, so don't lose heart. Don't be afraid. God is providing a champion. Goliath's challenge to Israel, back in verse 8, is to choose a man and let him come down to me. But as we know, it's God that he's challenging, and we find that it is God who chooses a man to fight. God fights it by providing a champion. And that's good news for us who are unable to fight and win. There's a champion who will fight on our behalf so that we can trust God's plan. So there's no need to be frightened. There's no need to fear. God's champion is here. And we see that the man God chooses is not a man that the rest of the Israelites would choose. He chooses what we see as an unlikely champion. It's one who isn't even in the army, but is away from the battle. He's looking after sheep. I'm sure you'd agree there's a stark contrast between how Goliath's introduced in a description of his armor and his size, and how David's introduced, as with his family, finding out he's the youngest son. He's not even in, he's not invited. His older brothers are out fighting. He's there looking after the sheep. We've seen before he can play musical instruments. Verse 15, he's traveling back and forth from Saul, where he's playing music, to looking after the sheep. David's not a warrior. He's not from a big city. He's from a small town. And how he gets to the battlefield, he's only at the battlefield because he's delivering food to his brothers, some bread and cheese. We see it also in Saul's response to David volunteering to fight in verse 32. Verse 32, David volunteers to fight. Verse 33, Saul replies, "You're not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. You're only a young man, and he has been a warrior from his youth." That says what Saul thought about the comparison between David and Goliath. And even after David has convinced Saul to let him go out and fight, Saul dresses David in his armor because he's thinking in terms of swords and spears and shields. He's not the champion Saul would have chosen. When Goliath sees David approaching, he's insulted. He sees a boy with a stick and is offended that the Israelites might think that this weak little thing could defeat him, the mighty warrior. Goliath doesn't think that David is in any way a champion. But David is the champion that God chooses. And that brings us to God chooses to bring someone to the battlefield to remove the disgrace. As David says, what will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? And God chooses David. And David is a man who trusts in God. We see his obedience to his father in following verse 20, particularly the description of what he does draws that out. But it's also God's sovereignty in bringing him there. And as we've seen, David trusts God. Here we're going to see a key contrast, whereas before in his appearance there was a contrast between particularly David and with Goliath. When we look at the difference between David and Saul and the rest of the Israelites, David has faith in God, and only David sees the situation correctly. Saul and the Israelites have forgotten God, and they're trusting in the power of men. They're looking to armor. On the one hand, we have Israel's fear. On the other, David's faith. The fear of Israel is first seen in verse 11. On hearing the Philistines' words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. They're terrified by Goliath's words. And then we find out that Goliath's been challenging them in verse 16 for 40 days, twice a day. And at no point during that time has anyone thought to go out and challenge Goliath. You have the rewards given by Saul. Saul himself doesn't go out. I mean, he's sort of is the Israelite king. He's their champion. He's the one who we hear about his height. We see his armor in later on when he's trying to give it to David. But he's not willing to go. And not even the significant reward of great wealth, no taxes, and a daughter to marry is enough to incentivize any of the Israelites to go and fight. They're too afraid. But David's faith in God is clear in him. Seeing the situation as a disgrace, someone that God is going to deal with, and God will help whoever goes out and fights for Israel. But also in verse 34 to 37, as he recounts God rescuing him from the wild animals, he gives complete credit to God. Verse 37, he's not talking about his skill in killing the lion and the bear, but he says, "The Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will rescue me from the hand of this Philistine." He has complete confidence in the fate of what the Philistine will be. Verse 36, you know, this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them because he has defied the armies of the living God. David sees Goliath not as a formidable giant who can't be beaten, but as an uncircumcised Philistine. Uncircumcised, so he's not part of God's people. He's not part of their covenant. He's challenging God. And, as we've seen, that's clear in both verse 26 and 36. He's defied God and will die. He cannot be allowed to go on. And we see that David doesn't need Saul's armor. He's not used to it. Instead of Saul's sort of faith in weapons, his faith is in God. He trusts God to deliver him with what he has. And David's faith is again shown in what he says in his speech against Goliath, when he goes out to meet Goliath. "This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands," in verse 46, "and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. This very day I will give you the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals." You know, Goliath says in verse 44 that he will give David's flesh to the birds and the wild animals, but David knows that it will be the other way around and turns the threat back on Goliath himself. He has some fighting talk of his own. But as we see, the situation, verse 45, is one of the sword and the spear against the name of God. It's God's strength that David is going out in. And so we think, there's these Israelites there, they're terrified, they've been facing this giant coming out for 40 days, morning and evening, challenging them. Then surely it's great news what they have in verse 32. As David says, "Let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go out and fight him." Here David's saying, actually, you don't need to be afraid. I'm going to go out and fight. You've been waiting for someone to fight Goliath. I'm here. I'll do it. But as you've seen, Saul's response is, "You're not able to go out." And I don't think that any of the Israelites were feeling any better from David having said that. They didn't have that faith in God. They didn't have faith in David to be able to go out and defend them. And so we find, with that, actually, we can say if you've got a problem, you don't need to be worried if someone is with you who can fix that problem. But if you don't think they can fix it, then actually you're still just as worried as you were before. If you have a problem in your house, say something with your plumbing, if you've got a plumber there who you're confident can fix it, yeah, it's fine, they'll fix it. But if you think they're an incompetent plumber and have no chance of fixing it properly, maybe based on some bad work they've done in the past, then actually you might still be worried, even if they say, "Don't worry, I can fix it." I think with these points we see, when David himself points us to Jesus as our champion. He's the one that fights the battle. He's the champion that the Lord provides. But the way that Jesus does it is in a way that seems so unlikely to us. Paul talks about it in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 of the foolishness of the world, how foolish the cross looks. As David went out to meet Goliath, he's there with nothing more than a stick, a small shepherd's bag, his sling. He's got no armor, he's no weapons. As we look at the cross as a way to defeat death, sin, Satan, it looks like complete foolishness to the world. How can that save anyone? How can one man dying on a cross save us? That doesn't look like the sort of champion I want to fight for me. But Jesus is the champion that David was ultimately pointing to. And the message of the gospel sounds weak. But it is the power of God for the salvation of all who believe. We don't need to dress it up like Saul tried to dress up David. We don't need to make it look more impressive. It is what it is. It's the way that God has chosen and how God has chosen to bring salvation to his people. And Jesus is so much better than David, and we see some of David's obedience in this chapter and his faithfulness in God. But Jesus is the champion who is perfectly obedient. He's the one who is able to fight not a giant, but to fight death itself and win. He didn't just die, but he rose from the dead. He defeated death completely. And isn't that great news for us? Sort of as we read David's words in verse 32, let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go out and fight him. So we can hear sort of Jesus saying, actually, don't lose heart. Don't be afraid at what Satan does, or at the attacks that he does. Don't be afraid of death. Don't be afraid of sin. It doesn't have power over you, because I will go out and fight them. David points us to Christ as our champion, but also David is an example for us. As we see his faith, as we see him trusting in God's plan, as we see him acting in light of that, we know that we too are called to live a life of faith. We know the Lord's rescuing power, so we shouldn't be looking to the appearances, how things appear, but the spiritual realities. The church may seem to be under attack. We may be in situations, when we look across at our country, it may be situations more personally in our lives, where we seem to have no chance of winning. But we can trust God as we approach death and sort of the consequences of our sin. We can trust God, God's plans of salvation. But why can we trust God's plans of salvation? Why, when so often things seem against us, when it doesn't seem that you sort of go, well, where is Jesus in fighting my battles? Things are still bad. I've still got all these threats. I'm still struggling with different things. There's all these problems going on. Where is this? But we know that the Lord wins victory. And that's a funny point. We see here complete victory for the Israelites, complete victory for God. And we know that the Lord wins complete victory through his champion. In our story here, the battle itself only takes a couple of verses. But the result and the reason for it is clear. The fight's over in a matter of seconds, but the outcome was never going to be anything else other than a complete victory for the Israelites. There's the expression, a David versus Goliath sort of contest. It's used quite often in football, things like the FA Cup, where you have a team from like the top division against a team from a lower division, and the lower team has no chance. They're always going to get beaten. They can try as hard as they can and impress with their effort, but they're always going to get beaten. And that's fairly a familiar expression to us. And this is a David versus Goliath battle, but actually in the context of that, you know, David was always going to win. Goliath stood no chance. It wasn't him who had the advantage. Verse 45, David is coming against him in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, who Goliath had defied. David was coming in the name of the Lord, and the Lord is more powerful than a sword. And then we find in killing Goliath, the enemy was defeated. The Israelites were saved. As David says in verse 46 to 47, this was for God's name, and is for the world to know. It's clear that God has won, and it's God who has won the battle. David comes in his name, he gives the credit to him. Verse 50 highlights that. The story could just go straight from verse 49 to 51. But verse 50 is in there as a comment and highlighting what David said just a few verses before in verse 47. All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's. And then verse 50, so David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and killed him. This is God who wins the battle. It's God who gets the credit. It is the Lord who saves his people. So salvation for his people. When the enemy attacks, salvation goes hand in hand with defeating the enemy. As David cuts off Goliath's head with Goliath's sword in verse 51. So I expect there all those who stood watching, still not able to believe what happened. Kind of time stood still. But once the Philistines realize that their unbeatable champion has been beaten, they turn and run, and the Israelites pursue them. Here, salvation for Israel meant defeating the enemy that was threatening them. And so for us, salvation for us means defeating the enemy that threatens us. It means defeating death, which is what Jesus did on the cross. 1 Corinthians sort of 15, verse 54 to 57, talks about this death and sin as its sting. But it says that we have victory in Jesus Christ. He has beaten death and won victory for us. David won victory for the Israelites he represented, but Jesus won victory for those that he represented in dying on the cross. In taking on himself our sin, He saves those who trust in him from fear of death, from the consequences of sin. And we don't see that completely yet. Paul also talks about in that chapter about how we don't have all the realities of that yet. We still die and then we'll be raised imperishable. But we know that the Lord is victorious, just as David had that confidence that this day the Lord will deliver you into my hands. So we can have the confidence that although we don't see the victory in its fullness yet, so on the day of the Lord, when Jesus returns, we will be saved and the enemy will be completely defeated. And so that's what should keep us going. When we're faced with troubles, when it doesn't seem like victory is at hand in those areas, have confidence. Look back at times when God has, the victory is clear. Look at the Bible where the victory is clear, and have faith that when God promises he will be that victory will be seen even more so in the future, that we will see that. We will live to see it, and we will die and see it even more after we have died. Secondly, the Lord wins victory. The Lord winning victory means glory for his name. The Lord doesn't just save his people, it's for his name. As we've seen, it's God who gets the credit throughout, and David gives the credit to him. But verse 46, 47, it's God, all through it, it's his name who's at stake. It's him who's been defied by a Goliath. It's him who's been mocked, but he saved his people to show his glory and to make his name and attributes known. As is verse 47, so that all those gathered here will know that the Lord saves. Verse 46, that the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. This happens so that people will know God, know who he is and what he does. And we see in David, he's not just confident that he's going to win, but he's also angry at this defiance. You know, this disgrace is what he calls Goliath. He's defying the living God. He's angry at that. And David gives credit to God. Verse 54, he puts the Philistines' weapons in his own tent, but later we find those weapons in with the priests. He gives that to God as a sign of victory. The God who is ridiculed by Goliath shows who is really powerful in coming forth in his name. This is about God's reputation and God's power, not about how great David is. And so it is for us. Actually, the great news of the gospel is not for people to know anything about us. It's not for people to know about how good we are answering questions or even how good we are. You know, God doesn't save us so that people could know us for our integrity or anything like that. Any sort of fruits of the Spirit that we might seek to show is to point to God. It's to give him the glory. David didn't defeat Goliath so that the Philistines and the whole world could know that there was a shepherd boy in Israel who was a good shot with a sling. Goliath was defeated so that the whole world could know that there was God and a God who saves. This cuts against a lot of what are sort of the notions of individualism in our society, about us being first and foremost, about people wanting our name to be known, about what we've done to get credit for what we've done. But that's not why God saves us. That's not what he's done. And actually, it doesn't help people to know what we've done or anything about that. But it's for God's glory. He's the king. He's our king. He's the one we want to tell people about. And that goes on to our third point, for the whole world to know. For the world to know. This happens so that the world will know there is a God in Israel. There is a God who acts and who saves his people, and there is a God who defeats his enemies. Just as the whole world, this happens so that the whole world will know there is a God in Israel. So Jesus dying on the cross and rising from the dead happened so that the whole world could go. Jesus' command to his disciples, you know, go and tell, make disciples of all nations, go and tell that to the world, to the ends of the earth, telling people about what has happened. And even that, the story of David and Goliath itself actually is an incredibly famous story. Most children know it. Most people who haven't read much about the Bible at all will know of David and Goliath. And actually that question, even within this story, still poses itself. Okay, you know the story of David and Goliath. You know how David won. But what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about the fact that there was a God in Israel then? This was a real place, a real event. God has acted in this way. And the same, there's that same question to us today as there was to the Philistines and the nations around them then. What are you going to do about the fact that God is there and he is a God that saves? Because on a different day in history, a different champion to David won victory. Jesus on the cross. And what are you going to do about that? There's that call for us to trust him. Actually, this is, for us as Christians, we are to trust him. To believe in what he said. Believe that the victory is won. But secondly, there's that call to actually tell people about it. To make it known to the world. To tell people to seek Jesus and his salvation that he offers. Because that's how the world will know. The world knows through us telling people about it. Just as then, the way that people will have known that there was a God in Israel through this event was because there would have been news spread through the towns and villages that this battle had taken place, that David had killed Goliath, that God had saved his people. And so it is with us. The way people are going to know about Jesus and his victory, as him as our champion, is through people telling them about it. We have more ways of communicating today than we did back then, but it's through people telling other people. That's how the world's going to know. Just as I, as you know, was away this weekend and wasn't able to play football yesterday for the team I normally play football for on a Saturday, but I got an email letting me know the score from someone on the team. Sadly, we lost 4-0. But, for example, you didn't know that until I told you. And just as many people in this world do not know about Jesus and do not know about the salvation he offers, and it's up to us to tell people about that. I'm always amazed when talking with students on campus and that kind of thing, actually how little people know about the Bible today. And that is a challenge we face, especially in this age. Most people don't know that we face a fierce enemy. They don't know about, they don't see death or sin as an enemy of God. And they don't know that God's provided a champion to fight that battle. They don't know that God, that through Jesus Christ, there is a champion that has already won. And if he's our king, if he's our representative, then we are on the winning side. We have that victory that we share in him. People don't know that God has won. They don't know that they can share in the victory. I just wanted to make a few comments about those final few verses. Verse 55 to 58. I think this particularly then forms a sort of a link onto the next section as we look at Saul and David interacting. And over the coming chapters, we'll see David and Saul and the different relationship that they have and how that changes. But particularly here we see, actually, immediately after David's gone out to meet the Philistine and comes back, holding Goliath's head, Saul's asking about, you know, who his father is. Whose son are you, young man? This is possibly because of the offer of rewards being that his family will be exempt from taxes. There's a probable explanation for that. But also, I mean, here we see David having shown the example of what the king should do. But actually, here sits Saul, who is the king of Israel, not doing what the king should do. And so there's the word the king said, find out whose son this man is. But actually, this is someone who isn't acting like a king at all. Here is the commander of the army and the king interviewing David about who his father is, while the soldiers are chasing the Philistines and winning the victory out there. And they're not doing that job. So yeah, we've seen that the battle is the Lord's. It's his battle, as David says in verse 47, the battle is the Lord's. Of all the fierce enemies we face, of all the threats that there are today, we know that anything that threatens us as God's people is an enemy of the Lord. And actually anything, or the things like sin and death and Satan that are against God, are a God battle that God will fight. And it's not something that we have to go out and fight ourselves. God has provided a champion. And so we don't need to be afraid. It's a champion that brings good news, a champion that volunteers to fight in our place. It's an unlikely champion. It's won in an unlikely way. But we can trust in God, just as David trusted in God. And with that faith, we don't need to be afraid. We don't need to fear. We can have confidence in the victory that has happened and the fruits of the victory that is to come. because it is the Lord who wins victory. He wins salvation for his people, and it is for the glory of his name, and that is something that we are to do in going out and telling people, in talking with people, letting them know what has happened, that there is a God, and there is a God who saves.